Right center field, Buxton back, and it's gone! Bo Bichette with number 26. A two-run home run to right center, and it's an early 3-0 lead.
Hey everyone, this is At the Letters presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, and our producers this week are Christian Ryan and Nicholas Andrade. And co-hosting with me this week is Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. Shai, all the way in St. Petersburg, Florida, where he's covering the Jays, making the time out of his schedule. So thanks for joining, Shai. Welcome.
A pleasure as always, Ben.
So we got a lot to get to. We talked to Josh Donaldson on the weekend. We'll have that interview a bit later in the podcast, but let's start with these Jays and what's going on with them. I mean, every single game has such high stakes right now. You were there at the Trop for their loss on Monday. What are your kind of big picture thoughts on this team right now?
Essentially, at this point, it's all math, right? They've got the four series left. They got two more with the Rays as we record this, three with the Yankees, three with the Orioles, four with the Twins. And, you know, the way that I broke it down, is the Jays essentially needed to go, you know, 3-3 through the stretch against Tampa Bay and New York, and then go 5-2 through the stretch against Minnesota and Baltimore. They do that. That should take them to 92 wins and get them pretty securely into the wild card, you would think, with 92 wins. But of course, that's easier said than done. And the Rays are just, they're a maddening team, right? On paper, they should not be as good as they are. And then they put it together and they're just so solid and they're so tough to play against. You know, the opener of that series was certainly an example of that. But, you know, I think the Blue Jays are very much in control of their own destiny. They have games in hand on both the Yankees and the Red Sox. And really, it's up to them what they do with it.
They're in a great spot right now. And it's, you know, it's funny. You mentioned the Rays, and I think there's this narrative surrounding the Blue Jays sometimes where it's like, you know, they can't win in Tampa Bay because it's the Trop and it's this house of horrors. And, you know, that's maybe true when it comes to the actual results. But, you know, I think the reality is just that the Rays are such a good team. I will not pick up on that thread. I will instead direct us more toward the Toronto Blue Jays and their pitching. And let's start there when it comes to kind of the big questions around this team, because I think that it's hard to fully discuss the Blue Jays and everything that's about to happen in the course of their next couple of weeks, in the course of their next playoff push potentially, without knowing what the status is of Hyunjin Ryu, without knowing what their options are. So what's your sense? I mean, we know he's on the injured list. We know he hasn't been effective. That's the baseline. And they're going to have a bullpen game essentially with Ross Stripling figuring in on Wednesday, but from there, you know, there's still a whole lot of questions. So what's your read on the Ryu situation right now?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is the primary question. And, you know, the other one is how or what can Nate Pearson and Julian Merriweather give them? We can talk about that in a bit. But with Ryu, my sense is right now, his 10-day IL stint would expire in time for him to pitch the opener of that Yankee series next week. And that seems to be the plan that they're on right now for him to pitch in that game. You know, they want him to rest that neck issue, get a bit of a breather. You know, I think that he's going to throw at least one side, probably two sides between now and then. You know, I'd expect the Blue Jays to maybe look at some sort of little tweak or adjustment for him to make in order for him to get command of the secondary stuff back into the zone. You know, he's been more or less there with the fastball in recent starts. Fastball velocity has been there, but, you know, the secondary has been inconsistent. If he doesn't have the secondary, well, you know, guys are going to tee off on 90-91 all day. So, you know, that's really the essential piece for him. And obviously, there's going to be a lot riding on this little down period between now and the opener of the Yankee series. You know, like if Ryu comes out in that start and does not pitch well, that'll leave the Blue Jays chasing it from a pitching perspective for the rest of the series, potentially. So certainly a big moment for him coming up. But, you know, as things stand right now, that's sort of where the Blue Jays are at and what they're aiming for.
It makes sense. And I mean, all you can do at this point, if you're the Blue Jays, is play the hand that's in front of you, and you can't make Ryu into the version of him that was a Cy Young finalist each of the last 2 years. He's just not that guy right now for whatever reason or reasons. So as they try to move ahead here, you just have to get a read on what he can give you. And it's tricky, though, because what you're doing is you're trying to assess him and you're also trying to win these games. So there is that push and pull where, you know, of course, you need to get a read on who Ryu is. If they're going to go on an extended run, that's a lot easier to do if Ryu is available to help in some way. But as things stand now, every game matters so much. So, you know, it's not like they have the luxury of just, you know, if they were in the Rays position and they have a 5 or 7 game lead in the division, you can do a lot of different things. But right now, there is a demand every single night to win the game in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Ben. The one thing that I will say is that at least the impression that I've gotten in the past few days is that the Blue Jays aren't quite as panicked as the fan base about this, which, you know, they generally should be. They should not be reacting to these blips with, you know, the raw emotion of a fan. But I think they're looking at it and they're seeing that Ryu's had the third most innings logged in his entire career. He, by and large, has gone wire to wire here. They've given him a few, an extra day here and there, but there hasn't been a lot of breaks built in. And he's coming off the pandemic shortened season where, you know, again, he led the team in innings, but, you know, you're going from sprint to marathon. And, you know, this is something that we, before the season started, we all thought would be a much more significant issue with pitchers than perhaps it's turned out to be. So I think they're looking at those factors and they're saying, you know, we give him a 10-day break, he makes a little bit of an adjustment, and he's going to be fine, right? Where, you know, I think, you know, at least judging by my Twitter mentions, everyone's ready to, you know, burn him at the stake and DFA him and, you know, cut ties and all this other stuff. So I think we're going to see who's right, and we're going to see whether their Blue Jays faith in Ryu is justified in what's going to be a very big start because of all the reasons you just outlined.
For sure. You know, I get some of those same mentions myself. And, you know, of course, there seems to be this pessimism even around like the 2022 and 23 portions of this contract. And to me, when I'm thinking about Ryu, like, I think he's going to be good next year out of the gate. And I think we've talked about this before where I'm like, you give this guy a full offseason of rest, he's going to come out in the beginning of next year and he's going to be a good starter for a certain amount of time. Like how long that lasts, we don't know. How long he can stay healthy, I mean, that's an open question. But the here and the now is really where, of course, the uncertainty exists because it is hard to know what you're going to get. And, you know, putting him up against the Yankees in a series that, you know, that 3-game series is basically going to feel like a playoff series. Like the stakes, mm-hmm. You could essentially knock the Yankees out or the Yankees could knock you out if you're the Blue Jays. So, I mean, that, like, even just looking ahead more broadly at that series, like what an intense period of time that's going to be for the Blue Jays as they try to secure some sort of playoff berth. You know, obviously the second wild card where they're situated as we record this on Tuesday, but a lot can change in the course of a very short period of time.
Yeah, for sure. But I'll touch on the Yankees series in a second. But before, you know, I think one of the things people are going to have to understand is that when you gave Ryu that contract, and at that point, you know, the Blue Jays weren't sort of this A situation that free agents were running to come to, right? Like free agents never want to come to the American League East in the first place. And at that point, you know, the Blue Jays were sort of this barren wasteland of pitching. And, you know, to get Ryu, you had to give him the type of deal that he got. And when you sign that deal, you know, part of what you're buying is decline where he's underperforming what you're paying for him. That's just the reality of free agency. That's going to happen with George Springer at some point down the line too. You know, that's the nature of these deals. So you accept that going into it. I think people are going to have to realize that, you know, Ryu's delivered the value of his contract in the first 2 years, and whatever comes in the next 2 seasons is sort of gravy at this point. So I think that's going to be an important way for people to kind of realize the reality of the Ryu contract. As for that Yankee series, you're absolutely right. But, you know, I think one of the reasons, you know, the way the Blue Jays rotation lined up where, you know, they're going to have Berríos and Ray to follow Ryu in that series, you know, I mean, it lines Berríos up for a potential 163. Yep. It lines Ray up for a wild card. But, you know, you're going 1-2-3 with your best dudes in that Yankee series. So, you know, I think that if you're the Blue Jays, you're like, okay, well, if Ryu does hit a speed bump, well, then, you know, the Yankees have to get through Berríos and Ray in the next 2 games. And I think that's probably a bit of a comforting feeling for them.
Oh, for sure. I mean, those are, you know, you look around the American League, there just aren't a lot of 1-2 combinations that would be better than that. I mean, it's honestly, like, it's the White Sox obviously have some great starting pitching. the Astros are pretty deep, the Rays, of course. But I mean, you're talking about the best teams in the American League. If you want to try to find a 1-2 combination that's that effective. So, you know, the Jays are in a good position. I think it made a lot of sense for them to line things up the way they did and going into this past weekend to just adjust their plans slightly and make sure that Robbie Ray would be that guy who's lined up for a wild card game. Jose Berríos would be that guy who's lined up for a 163 because, you know, as well as say a Steven Matz has pitched or, you know, even Alek Manoah, who's definitely outperformed anything the Blue Jays could have reasonably expected. But those, you know, Matz certainly isn't someone you want in a must-win game. And I think Berríos and Ray are the guys. So to me, that was a decision that made a lot of sense for this team.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think this is why you acquired Berríos, right? Yeah. You acquired him for those kind of leverage games and then to have him for the playoffs afterwards. So, you know, the reason the Blue Jays were willing to pay such a steep price in prospect capital to get him. So there was a bit of luck in terms of how the rotation lined up and that it happened to work out this way, that all they have to do is sort of pull Matz and then reinsert him a couple of days later for this to work out. You know, if they had to do a little bit more acrobatics in their rotation to get Ray on the schedule, it might have been a bit of a challenge for them because the Blue Jays want to keep Ray, and Ray prefers this, to be on regular rest. Yeah. And to take the ball every 5 days. So things fell into place a little bit for them, the way the rotation played out. But yeah, it's certainly exactly set up exactly the way that it should be, because you can't have Matz in, you know, and no disrespect to Steven Matz, but you can't have him lined up for a wild card or anything along those lines.
No. Yeah. You don't want that. And I mean, it might be a situation where, depending on how the next few days go, like, they might have to win 5 of 6 to get in. And in that case, you are putting Steven Matz out there in a must-win game, essentially. And, you know, Ross Stripling could be in a must-win game. Like, you don't know how things are going to unfold. But to the extent that you can control things and line things up, it makes sense for the Jays to be in this spot. Now, Shai, you also mentioned the prospect capital that the Jays gave up to get Jose Berríos. And it was significant in Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson. I did want to touch on that briefly because, you know, since then, Berríos has been very good, kind of exactly what you would have expected if you kind of had to predict it. Austin Martin getting on base at AA for the Twins, still no power, which is interesting. So his OPS is just shy of 800 and his on-base percentage over 400, but basically no power. Woods Richardson has made 4 appearances, 3 starts, and high ERA, a lot of walks. So has your perspective on this trade changed in the course of the last, I guess, nearly 2 months now since they made it?
You know what? It hasn't, because especially with guys who are relatively young, you know, Austin Martin's really in what's essentially his first full year of pro baseball. You know, I don't want to count last summer, you know, the time at the complex. And I don't know that that's fair to say, call that a proper year of professional baseball. And then Simeon Woods Richardson, you know, is essentially, you know, he's still a kid, right? Is he, I'm not even sure if he's 20. I still think he's 19 or maybe just turned 20.
Super young.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much growth, and he's already at AA, and he's probably 3 or 4 years beneath the average age for the level that he's pitching at. So, you know, to rush right now and say, yeah, this was a steal for the Jays, I think that's an overreaction. But I think the one perspective that I've really kind of picked up over the past couple months, and it really started for me when at the Futures game, when Martin represented the Blue Jays, is that there's a pretty deep split on what he's going to be, right? I think there's general agreement that he's going to be a good player,
yeah,
but is he going to be a superstar? And I think that's where there's a pretty strong strain of opinion that thinks that, you know, his ceiling is probably like a high OBP center field guy who's not going to hit for power. And that's still really valuable. It's a great asset, especially if he can, you know, become a decent defender in center field. But, you know, if he can't handle center and then he ends up in a corner and he's not hitting for power, then, you know, how does that profile, right? You know, that profile's a little bit better in the infield if he could play second or something along those lines or shortstop. But I don't know that that's clear at this point. And so what you have essentially is, you know, a high OBP no power guy with potentially not a position. And I think that's part of what the Blue Jays saw. You know, nobody will say that even privately, doesn't want to acknowledge that. But I think there was at least that possibility in sort of his trajectory and how he trended out or projected out. And, you know, I think that's part of why the Blue Jays were willing to make a move with him. You know, if they thought he was going to be Bo Bichette or Vladimir Guerrero Jr., they're no not
chance.
Trading him.
No chance.
I guess the biggest reassessment I've had is sort of my perception of what I thought Austin Martin was going to be. And then maybe sort of a more realistic take on what the possible outcomes for him are.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because if he turns out to be David Fletcher or Adam Frazier, one of these guys who can, you know, hit 300 and have a 380 OBP and still a good 800 OPS, I mean, that's a good player. That's a major league player. And as you look ahead, the Toronto Blue Jays, of course, have room for someone like that. Probably third base is the most glaring positional need on this team for the long term. I guess second base too, with Semien hitting free agency. But that's a void that someone like Austin Martin could have filled. And yet, if he's not that superstar Alex Bregman type player, then you're probably okay trading him and Woods Richardson for Berríos, who now is in that position to impact multiple pennant races and maybe even multiple playoff runs. So it is interesting to kind of reassess those trajectories after a couple months. And for me, it would be, I would have a slightly different opinion now. At the time of the trade, as you know, because we were sitting in the press box as this was happening, you know, I was like, this is a huge return. You know, I was a little like, you know, thrown off that the Jays had done that. I was surprised. And now, you know, I can see more pathways where this works out in the Blue Jays' favor.
Yeah, for sure. And I thought, same as you, I think we were reacting about the same way. We were staring at each other in disbelief when I got word that Martin was in the deal, and you looked at me and were like, what? But I think for me was the shock, not the shock at the price as much as I didn't think that the Blue Jays were going to be willing to do that at that point in time, right?
Like,
A lot of the conversations that I had that week, I think the Blue Jays were really wrestling with whether this was the time to do it. But, you know, if you can get Berríos, and this is interesting, it's not a direct parallel, but there's a bit of a similarity. You know, the Blue Jays had Robbie Ray here last year. You know, they made an impression on him. He made an impression on them, and they decided to re-sign him. And then, you know, obviously this year has happened, right? They've got a year and a half with Berríos. So they've got a year and a half head start on all the other teams who could potentially bid for him when he's eligible for free agency in 2022. And if they can make it comfortable, they can make him happy, they certainly will have the financial wherewithal to get that done. They're not going to get outbid by somebody. So, you know, if they can just convince him that this is where he needs to be, you know, they get a head start. And that's part of what they're paying for too. And that is a potential difference maker. Because again, like, pitchers aren't running to come to the American League East, right? Like, you know, Gerrit Cole fulfilling a childhood dream to pitch for the New York Yankees, you know, that's a bit of an aberration, an outlier, right? Nobody's coming to this division to get their brains beat out. So, you know, I think anything the Blue Jays can do in terms of building relationships in advance. And plus, you know, I think the Blue Jays can also figure out a little bit more about him. I think they knew him pretty well. They had some pretty good insights on him, but all the more now that they've gotten to see him firsthand, you know, like, they know what they're signing up for. So if they're going to bet on somebody, you bet on the guy you know, the guy you've had touches with, and all those things. And, you know, I think for all those reasons, you know, all this deal starts making a lot more sense when you're looking at it a bit in hindsight.
It's interesting. Now, a couple deals that did not work out as well were supposed to help the bullpen. Brad Hand, Joaquin Soria, hasn't really worked out that way. And yet you have two trades, Richards, Simber, that are working out really well for this team as they head into that final stretch. So before we wrap up here, Shai, what's your read on the Jays bullpen? To have Richards, Simber, obviously you've got Pearson maybe emerging. I mean, he has flashes and then he has outings where it's not quite there. Merriweather hasn't looked good. And of course you have Meza and Romano. So as you look at this collective group, clearly they're improved by a significant margin compared to where they were a couple months ago. But every week is different. It brings its own set of challenges, brings its own set of potential pitfalls. What's your read on this bullpen now as they head into that final stretch?
Well, I think you set it up pretty well there. You know, I think they're comfortable with what Richards and Simber can do. And they're obviously comfortable with Meza and Romano. And they're really hoping that one of, if not both, one of Pearson or Merriweather pops. Because if they just get that one more piece, then all of a sudden they can, you know, use guys on opposite days. They can reduce the potential back-to-back pressures, and they can shorten a game if they, on a day where, you know, maybe the starter can only go five. It's a five and dive kind of day, and you gotta nurse a one or two run lead for four innings. You know, then you've got more depth and you've got more options, and you're not naked the next day. So, you know, I think that's why, as much as the Blue Jays weren't, you know, they weren't counting on Ray going only 4 2/3 Monday night, but they gave them a chance to, you know, have Merriweather come in and clean up an inning, and then, you know, give Pearson an inning, and you know, wasn't ideal. Pearson ended up giving up a run, and, you know, had another one of those, you know, the stuff looks electric, but he's not correct that sharp. You know, the Blue Jays have to find a way to get those guys the ball and get them some reps, because, you know, they haven't pitched a ton and they need to catch up because of the injuries from the lost time, so they can get sharp and they can just have that, you know, mound experience that is missing, so they can, you know, when the pressure's on, they can rear back and make a pitch. And if one of those two guys finds it in the next week and a half, you know, that'll be potentially the difference between, you know, having a good bullpen and a bullpen that can really do some damage in the playoffs.
If you're the Jays, you're comfortable going to Romano three in a row?
I think they're definitely comfortable two in a row. And if he feels up for three in a row, they're going to do it at this point.
Like if the pitch count is low enough.
Right. And, or if he's just, you know, as long as he's not going out there with the potential to hurt himself and he can still bring it, they're not worried about the next day. And, you know, this is put up or shut up time, right?
Yeah. So no doubt.
You know, I think Romano wants it in that spot too. So, you know, I think it's all, you know, basically, you know, how they have the sort of green, yellow, red for their usage on pitchers. I think Romano, Meza, they're always going to be in yellow after back-to-backs. So sort of use with caution. But, you know, as long as neither of them feels like they're going to put themselves at risk, you know, the Jays are going to do that at this point.
Well, I was going to ask you, Meza, because coming back from TJ, I mean, I don't know if I'd go three in a row for him. I would with Romano. I don't know if I would with Meza. Like, I think I don't know. Until you get to the playoffs, I don't think I would.
Yeah. And I think, again, it would be sort of a proceed with caution. Yes. And maybe it's just come in for in a key spot and, you know, where, you know, you potentially finish an inning as just one, maybe two batters, and then you can get him out of the game after that. You know, that might be sort of his third day, or if it's just a shorter usage and quick usage in the first 2 days. But, you know, if it's 20 pitches, then, you know, I don't think we're seeing him on a third day.
Right. You know, it was interesting. I noticed Nate Pearson was warming up the day after he pitched. So that's telling me that they're willing to go to him back to back, which I think is fine. I think that makes sense. I mean, he's not coming back from an arm injury. It's a sports hernia. So it's not an arm injury that he's coming back from. So I see no reason for him not to be able to go back to backs as well.
Yeah, exactly. And he feels comfortable doing it too. So that's not a concern. I mean, they've got, from a physical perspective, I think they're fine with him. It's just for him, it's just finding that command and that rhythm. And it's just, you know, when you haven't done something on a consistent basis and then you have to go do it on a stage with a lot of pressure in games of incredible import to your team, you know, that's a tough spot, right? Because you're feeling like you're physically playing catch up to guys who have been, you know, going at it all season long. So I think that's what they're facing with both Pearson and Merriweather. And can they line that up and can they find that in time for, you know, the games of leverage before the season ends and into the postseason? You know, that's sort of the million-dollar question for the bullpen right now.
For sure. Okay, we will take a break there. When we come back, we will have Keeping It Light. We will talk to Josh Donaldson, and we will also touch on the Blue Jays' third base situation as it unfolds here down the stretch. All coming up on At the Letters. Welcome back to At the Letters, and it is time now for Keeping It Light, presented by Miller Lite. So, Shai, this year, you know, we're getting to the point of the season, the teams are starting to clinch. And in years past, you and I have both covered clinching celebrations, quite an experience to be in the clubhouse for those moments, and for obvious reasons. That will not be the case this year. We will not be inside the clubhouse. Maybe there'll be some champagne sprayed on a Zoom call. I don't know. We won't, you know, we'll have to see how that all unfolds. But from your standpoint, as someone who's covered, you know, not only the Blue Jays, but different playoff teams, different celebrations over the years, what are the best and worst aspects of covering a champagne celebration as a team clinches a huge moment in their season?
Well, I think the best is, in some ways it's kind of obvious, but at least for me, I really like seeing people who have worked really hard towards a shared goal, achieve it, and then just sort of let loose. And you see, like, it's absolute joy for them, right? Like, it's just such an emotional release where, you know, you've fought and you've grinded and you've struggled, and then you get a reward. And so I think what you often see in those celebrations is a lot of the tension and struggle and persistence and grind that players endure over the course of a season just sort of come out. They sort of just let loose. And it's fun to see people who are that happy, who have succeeded. The worst part of it is just getting drenched, right? Yeah. Like, flat out. You know, sometimes, you know, players may want to come get you for a reason. And you think a couple times people have, you know, poured me. I remember coming out of one of those and running into a Blue Jays executive who looked at me and said, "Wait a minute, you're coming out of this way too dry," and grabbed the champagne bottle and doused me. So, you know, that part of it, you know, I don't necessarily need that. Not necessarily the funnest way to go in right afterwards. You know, I mean, you've been in them and they're just chaotic. And, you know, I think sometimes it's certainly fun to be there, but it can also, it's not the easiest time to sort of do your job.
No, it's totally different. I mean, it's, yeah, you know, most of the time you have the luxury of, all right, I'm going to sit down at my computer and try to write something and organize my thoughts. And it's just, if there's champagne spraying everywhere, you know, you're not going to have particularly organized thoughts or well thought out questions, or at least I certainly haven't in those situations. So totally agree with you on the downside. But that being said, like, it is a cool environment. And I think that you really do see players let their guard down, because, like, we were there at Fenway Park when the Blue Jays clinched in 2016 and, you know, earned the right to move on ahead and continue the playoff run, which they ended up extending against the Orioles and Rangers. But, you know, they were so ecstatic in those moments to have clinched the wild card, and I think really understandably so.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the thing that gets lost in the no clubhouse era, and, you know, I certainly don't want to whinge about being able to work in a pandemic and right, having to deal with restrictions, because certainly just grateful to be able to continue to do our jobs. But, you know, I can think about little details that we picked up in 15, 16, you know, in 16, you, Arden, myself, we put together a scenes from the clubhouse piece, which had a lot of really fun things that you just won't get now, right? And little bit of insights about how players celebrate. Remember, there's, you know, Troy Tulowitzki FaceTiming with his son, and, you know, some of the Blue Jays were watching some of their younger teammates go a little too crazy, and some of the quips and, you know, some of the color from that moment. That's getting lost in this era in general. And it's moments like that that I think connect fans to the sport and that are important for the bigger picture. You know, I know a few teams have been talking about it, that if they do have a celebration, that, you know, they'll bring players out to the field for interviews so it can be done in person in a safer fashion. And I think that may be sort of the bridge that we do while we're sort of trying to maintain health and safety protocols for everyone involved. But, you know, I think these are the moments that really connect fans to teams and, you know, create fans for extended periods of time. And, you know, if some of that gets lost, you know, that's not good for the health of the sport overall.
Right. And it does create lasting memories. I mean, not only for the fans, but, you know, we talked to Josh Donaldson on the weekend, and this is a player, obviously, who was front and center for that 2015-16 run, the MVP in 2015. And, you know, even years later, the Twins now on the outside looking in, they're not going to make the playoffs. And when we caught up with Donaldson, like, it was interesting to hear that, you know, he certainly holds those memories pretty highly when it comes to his major league career.
There was clearly a connection between him and this city. And whatever different people think about it, he really felt at home here. He produced some of the best baseball of his career here. And he was a really important player at a really important time. Because, you know, if he doesn't come in and do what he did and, you know, perform the way that he did, you know, 15 and 16 don't happen. And, you know, where is this fan base now? You know, would the fan base have been, you know, as energized, and would, you know, and all the different business impacts that that had, right? Because all of a sudden everyone was like, yes, this is a powerful, powerful market. And, you know, the baseball fans that had been dormant since 92, 93, you know, that passion is just there. It's just been waiting to be reignited. And once it did, you know, it showed the full power of that market. And, you know, it went from theory to reality. And that certainly changed the business outlook for 16 and beyond. So, you know, he's really impactful in a number of different ways. And I think you can still hear in his voice the connection that he has to the city, the appreciation he had of being on those teams. And I think both of us will agree, you know, we found him really insightful to talk to during his time here. You know, a guy who thinks about the game in a different way, at a bit of a higher level than the average player. And, you know, he's certainly, I thought that came through in the interview and the discussion we had.
Coming up next on At the Letters, our conversation with Josh Donaldson.
We're here with Josh Donaldson. And Josh, Friday, with the reception you got, we clearly saw the type of impact that you made here during your time in Toronto. I'm wondering, what kind of impact did the time in Toronto make on you?
I mean, it was a huge moment in my career. It was a huge moment for me personally. You know, making the move over and transition to over here. I was explaining to some you know, Minnesota writers the other day. It was like from day one when I got here, the fans immediately took to me. I don't know why. I don't know what that was, for what reason, but it was something that was very special for me. And, you know, it was a very gratifying experience being here. And, you know, even since I've left, Blue Jays fans, people of Canada have still shown their appreciation for me in the time that, you know, I spent here.
Josh, when you think about how that team came together, how, you know, the pieces that were in place, there was the long drought and they hadn't been able to get over the hump. You know, you came, Russ Martin came, Tulo came later, David Price, all the moves that were made. But when that team clicked in a really significant way. And you've been around a bunch of different successful teams over the course of your career. Mm-hmm. What was unique about that team? Why do you think that team was able to come together the way that it did?
Well, I mean, I think if you go back and look at 15, at the All-Star break, we were hovering like right around 500. And I still, probably one of the like coolest moments, like personally for me, was after we had the trade for Tulo, LaTroy, and, you know, we got Mark Loeb and Revere. And then when we got David Price, and I walked into the clubhouse for that that time, and I was like, I'm looking around the clubhouse and seeing all the, and we already had some dudes, we already had dudes there, but we were kind of like on that mark of like, like we're a pretty good team, we could swing it, but did we have enough on the other side to really do damage? And when Alex Quinn made those trades, it was like, I walked in, I had goosebumps when I walked in. I'm like, we have a legitimate chance to win it all. And unfortunately we didn't, but all of us believed that we had that chance.
So now we're at a point in the season, obviously, for the teams like the Jays that are kind of pushing for the playoffs, that guys are banged up and they're still trying to play through things. It was apparent at the time, we didn't know exactly what, but you know, guys on those 15, 16 teams, yourself included, played through stuff and were banged up. At that point in the season, like, what kind of challenge does that pose? And what, you know, in hindsight, as you look back at that, and obviously you've been in the playoffs many times since then as well, but what is that challenge as a player to kind of push through at that, you know, pivotal point of the season?
I don't know necessarily if it's a challenge just because you want to be out on the field, right? And it's just tempering. It's just really understanding, like, what can I do and what am I limited at doing right now? Trying to bring that best version. And when you're banged up, you have to focus more. And you have to be smarter about the decisions that you're making on the field. I mean, there hasn't been too many seasons throughout my career where it was like, oh, hey, I mean, after week one, like, you're feeling like your body feels it. I mean, with the amount of travel, with the amount of games that we play on a day-to-day basis, you know, you're going to go through things. And it's just a matter of putting in the work and preparation before games and, you know, letting the game, you know, happen and play.
Josh, similarly, the situation that you find yourself in this season with Minnesota, maybe there are some similarities a little bit to 2017 here, but this isn't a situation you're familiar with, being on a team that's not playing for the postseason at this point. And knowing you, you don't like losing. You don't particularly want to lose well or ever handle that well. What is this like for you right now? And maybe what are you taking from that experience in 17 that you're trying to use here right now?
Yeah, I mean, the difference is right now for us, and like the message that I'm trying to, you know, share with our guys and really get people to understand is we are, like, we're still playing to win, right? Even though we're out of it, we're not going to make it to the playoffs. Like, we're setting the foundation now to go into the next season, to where next season we don't show up and it's like, oh, hey, like, are we going to win this year? No, like, we're going to go out and prepare to win today. So next year it's not, oh, we're trying to flip a switch, now we got a chance to win. No, we're going out there to prepare, and the people that we have here, we're going to go through some growing pains at times, but it's a continuing learning experience. And, you know, for me to this day, it's still a learning experience. I'm constantly learning about myself, learning about the game. And, you know, to me, when you stop learning, that's when, you know, shortly thereafter, you're probably not playing too much harder.
So back in, I guess, 17, 18, in those springs, you would have seen, and they would have been prospects at the time, but Vladdy, Bo, you would have been around those guys as they're kind of coming up through the system. Now, here they are. I mean, they're all-stars. Vladdy, I mean, pretty much the MVP of the league, unless you go with Otani, but having an amazing season. I mean, what were your kind of memories of them coming up, and what have you seen from them since that time?
They weren't really at big league camp with us during those times. They played in some big league games, but it was normally they'd go on the road when the veteran guys weren't going to go on the road. So I didn't get to see a lot of them. But I got to see and hang around Vlad a little bit in 18 when I was injured and when I was in Dunedin. And I walked away, you know, impressed with the fact of how his maturation at the plate was ahead of his age at that time. And he's continued to grow in that area, and, you know, he's having a remarkable year this year. And it's, I was having a talk earlier, I mean, to me, when you talk about most valuable, it's a guy who's playing on winning teams. I mean, you can do whatever you want. What ultimate value is, why we play the game, is to win. And so that's where you bring the most value.
So you've been there, like, you won the MVP. Or, you know, when you look at this race, you see Vladdy ahead of Otani then?
I mean, I feel like I'm going against the grain, but I don't really know why people would think I'm going against the grain. And it's not me showing any type of favoritism or anything like that, but to me, he's the most valuable. He plays every day. You know, he's having a remarkable year for a team, you know, if they get to the playoffs.
Yeah.
Now, if they don't make the playoffs, the debate is a little bit different. because Shohei possesses the ability to do something that we've never seen before in our lifetime. And he's had an incredibly offensive year as well as on the mound. My only argument against Shohei not being the unit like MVP at the moment is they're not making the playoffs, and he's also not playing like both sides of the ball every day. And the value that he holds as a pitcher is remarkable, but he's not doing that on every 5 day. If he was doing it every 5 days and putting up the numbers that he was doing, I feel different about the situation. But he hasn't necessarily done that. And I'm not knocking Shohei or trying to say his season is bad by any stretch of the manner, so I don't want people to think that. I think what he's doing is remarkable. I just think, to me personally right now, Vlad is showing more value on an everyday basis than what Shohei is doing. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, and totally fair. I think what was interesting, I can recall in 15 when you were here, the way that you poured into your teammates, and that was certainly part of the MVP discussion. You know, I think a lot of Blue Jay fans will remember pretty famously, you know, the rallying call, the "this isn't the Tri League, this is the Get It Done League," all that element that you brought. Just from a player perspective, what are some intangibles that the general public doesn't get to see that you think are significant and could potentially be factored in, or should be potentially factored into the MVP conversation?
I think if you pull Vlad, this is a good lineup. Toronto has a really, really good lineup overall, up and down. But if you pull Vlad out of the lineup, it's not the same. You can make the case that for Shohei as well, but like I said, to me it goes back to winning. And the Blue Jays are winning more at this moment. And I don't know what Vlad's doing in the clubhouse. I don't know those type of things that I could answer if I was involved in that. But he's doing something. He's doing something from whether it's the standpoint of when he walks up to the batter's box, the guys in the dugout, they're like, "Oh no, like we hope he gets it done." They already know that he's more likely going to get the job done. And what that does to guys in the lineup is it takes pressure off everybody else. So if they don't get the job done, they're like, "All right, yeah, we have our security blanket here." In baseball, I think it kind of gets overlooked to some extent because, I mean, you think of like a LeBron James, you think of guys who are like a Tom Brady per se. Everybody knows that those guys had the ball in their hands, that we're okay. You know, Vlad doesn't get to touch the ball every time, but the few times that he gets to step in the box and impact the game, those guys know that he's coming through, and he's done that this year. And so that intangible of saying, "Hey, we got our guy here, he's doing his thing," and I've noticed it for myself this year, like when I haven't been right at the plate, it impacts not just me, but it impacts our lineup throughout. Because now everybody else starts trying to do more than what, you know, maybe they envision themselves doing. It puts more pressure on those guys to where he's taking that burden to go out there and, you know, put the team on his back. And now it allows everybody else to play to the, you know, to their capability.
We've seen Vladdy like in the last maybe 6 weeks, like he had a slump for maybe 3-4 weeks in there, and he actually came back from it. So as someone who's obviously played at a very high level for a long time, gone through slumps, kind of bounced back in season, in the midst of that grind, like what do you have to be able to do to recover in season, make those adjustments physically, mentally, potentially, technically with the swing? Like what goes into that?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, guys tinker here and there. I've definitely been a guy throughout my career that will tinker and kind of try to get back, you know, to the foundation of our swing. I think what kind of gets overlooked as well is, you know, what this team's had to go through this year. You know, they start in Florida, then they have to go to Buffalo. And with all of, like, the hearsay of not really knowing, like, what are they going to do? Where are we going to be? And then end up getting back to come to Toronto. Right? Like, those are big moves that are happening throughout the year to where you're having to make big changes throughout to where that can impact the team. So I don't know what his numbers were in those 3 weeks that you're talking about, but when I look at the scoreboard, it doesn't look like it was that bad of a slump. So when the guy has 1,000 OPS, I'm not going to sit here and say the guy was slumping. The guy's kind of had a ridiculous year. And even more so, I mean, being 22 years old, doing the major changes that we've all, or what they've had to go through, carrying the load for the squad, I mean, it's remarkable. And you have two players in Shohei, a guy that we've never seen do this before in our lifetime, that's doing it at an extremely high level. There is some holes to the argument for him. Not making every fifth start, not pitching, from what I hear, I don't know if it's, I just seen it the other day that they might shut him down from the pitching standpoint of it, and then just DHing to where he's impacting, you know, really one side of the game, to where, you know, Vlad's going out there every day and he's doing it. And I respect that. Like, as a player, I respect the guy that's going out there and doing it every single day.
And good defense, too. His defense at first has gotten a lot better.
So I don't know what his defensive metrics are, but at the end of it, him being on the field in general impacts the game. Because he's in the lineup, he's playing, he's at first base, and he's, to me, he's doing it more often.
We'll wrap up just kind of casting forward for yourself. You know, you're a guy who's always thinking ahead and trying to think about what you're going to do for next season. For yourself, what will you take from this year? What will you look to accomplish next season for yourself?
I mean, to me, this year has been a pretty strange year for me, for the fact that I've done a pretty deep dive into a lot of my analytics to where it's like I've hit the ball harder than I've ever hit the ball in my career. I have more barrels, like, per percentage of at-bats. And I've had, you know, some unfortuitous luck. Last night, I mean, it was like I got a hit ball down the line, and third baseman didn't make a good play on me. And I was, like, in shock. It was actually, I was like, crap. I'm like, I got a cheap hit, like, cheapish type of hit down the line, and then, you know, my fifth at bat, I smoke a ball at the middle, and of course the second baseman's right there. So that's kind of been like my, that's been my shtick this year, to where it's been tough. Like, I'd say mentally it's been tough, because as you know, for me, like, I don't take the failure well, you know. And this year it's kind of been a mixed bag of, like, I feel like I'm doing what I want to do, and I'm not getting the results that I want to do or that I normally have. As far as, like, from a number standpoint, but I look at my analytics, I'm like, my analytics say it's the best I've ever done. It's been all, like, confusing. So really just trying to get back. I feel like the last month of the season, my body, my mind, and everything's gotten a lot clearer of what I want to do, and go into the off season and having a plan, which I try to every year. And you know, that just comes with more understanding and just trying to find as much knowledge as possible.
Appreciate the time, Josh.
All right, guys.
Thanks, Josh.
So there it is, Josh Donaldson. Really interesting conversation. Enjoyed talking with him, Shai. I think we both, like, afterwards, you start thinking about the MVP discussion. It's really interesting. I mean, I personally, I would still lean towards Shohei Ohtani. Like, I just think that what he's doing is so, so special. But I also think, like, to go a little bit meta here, when it comes to the MVP discussion or the Cy Young discussion, part of me also thinks, like, there's still 2 weeks left in the season. Like, we can also just let it play out and then just see where things land. Because, you know, there's no need to declare a winner at every juncture of the season. There's really, you know, the season's not over yet.
Right. So I checked this on the weekend, and this is just the BWAR number, but there was only 1.7 WAR difference between Ohtani and Guerrero at that point. And there's a couple more weeks, and, you know, if Ohtani's not going to pitch anymore, and, you know, or whatever, the however that plays out there, I don't know, that gap could narrow. And if it's a little bit thinner and Guerrero leads the Jays into the postseason, I don't know that the gap is quite as wide as people are making it out to be. And, you know, Ohtani's pathway to that WAR is absolutely remarkable and historic. and something unlike anything we've ever seen before. But, you know, I thought Josh Donaldson's argument, like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. brings more value on a daily basis, was not wrong, right? Like when Otani's hitting, he's in the DH spot. So he's contributing on the defensive side of the ball once every 5 days. Now that's significant, but you know, that Guerrero's playing defense every day. He's showing up every day. As you know, when you talk to players, the one thing that they value are guys who show up and are steady every day. But then all the other intangibles that Guerrero brings to that lineup. And, you know, as much as it's a deep lineup, he still is in a lot of ways the straw that stirs the drink there. You know, I just don't think the gap is as wide as people are making it out to be.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It already is. And I mean, if Vladdy can hit 50 home runs, which in itself is incredible, that we're talking about a 22-year-old who might hit 50 home runs in a season. If the Jays make the playoffs, which, you know, they're looking like they have a great chance of doing that, that would be an incredibly strong MVP case. You know, I guess if you look at it the other way and you're kind of like, okay, you take a player who's really great offensively, but not quite as great as Vlad. So, you know, imagine on the Jays, like what if Marcus Semien also had pitched 125 innings of like a 330 ERA? Then I'd be like, that's so incredible. You know, like how is Shohei Ohtani doing this? Or how would Marcus Semien be doing that? Like if you think about it, like how just unbelievable it is that he's actually able to hit at an elite level. He has four more home runs than Marcus Semien. Like his numbers are better, and he's a pitcher. It's hard to fathom how any player could beat Shohei Ohtani for MVP this year. And I think that in itself tells us just how good Vladdy has been.
For sure. And the interesting element, and you know, Josh touched on it there, but I've heard this from a few other players in the past couple of weeks as I've been chatting with them about various things. The fact that Vlad is doing what he's doing in a playoff chase versus Ohtani, who's doing it without the daily stakes, you know, should that factor in? And, you know, certainly Blue Jays players that I've spoken to are pretty biased and they clearly think that it should. But, you know, I mean, Donaldson doesn't have a horse in this race, and, you know, he's very much there. It's like, you got to do it when it matters, right? You did do it for something when it matters. And that's a prevailing thought because it's different, right? It's, you know, is Ohtani doing the same things if, you know, every game matters and it's life and death and he's being game planned in a different way? Now you can argue, okay, well, you know, how much better would he potentially be doing if Trout and Rendon were in the lineup every day around him? And, you know, I think the what if game becomes pretty difficult. At a certain point, you just have to start analyzing what is. But, you know, I do think that there's some value to that where, again, if Guerrero can continue to close that war gap between the two over the next couple weeks, and then he's led the Blue Jays to the postseason, you know, at that point, as much as it's unique, I think that there's a very, very compelling and strong argument that Vlad should be the guy.
Yeah, and I do think that voters like strong finishes. I do think that it plays in to some extent. So we'll see where it goes. Well, you know, as long as we're talking about kind of these numbers and the you know, old school versus maybe newer school ways of looking at things, I do want to raise the topic of RBI. And I mean, I'm not a big RBI guy. Like it's not a stat that I look at. But there are moments where I do find myself kind of gravitating to old school stats, like just moments. Like, okay, John Lester won his 200th game. I think that's cool. Like, I think that's like, at that point, it's interesting to me. Although, you know, I could care less if he goes 7-9 this year or 13-4. It doesn't matter to me. But if you zoom out, you know, you get to 200 wins, okay, that you're doing something pretty impressive. And on a Jays level, this is a team that has six players with at least 80 RBI. And again, like, I don't care about RBI. I really don't. Except for, okay, you have six players with 80 RBI. Now, for some reason, I care. Does this make any sense to you?
No and yes. So it makes sense to me that you care because those are eye-popping numbers. And, you know, they're already at 200 RBI guys. And before long, Marcus Semien and Bo Bichette should make it four. So that's pretty bananas, right? It tells you, it's an illustration of just how potent in offense this is and how productive those players are. I will say this, you know, I recently had a discussion with a baseball official, and you may have been around for this one. I'm not sure if you were, but I had said, like, why do we even still have wins? Why is this even still a stat? It's so irrelevant. Nobody cares about it. But players care about RBIs, right? Like, I was talking to George Springer recently, and he was talking about Vlad's RBI production. And in the player view, when guys can knock in runs and deliver in those moments, that says something. And yes, it's circumstantial that you need players around you to put yourself in position to drive in runs. And it's not solely within your control, right? Like, you can be an amazing player in a terrible lineup and not get a lot of RBIs because there's simply no opportunities. And that's not your fault. But when guys tend to consistently put up RBI numbers, it usually a sign that they can execute in RBI situations. And I think players look at it that way. Rightly or wrongly, players do look at it that way. So I think there's something to it. I don't think, like, I think there's definitely more to it than wins, right? Because wins is completely, to me, just like, stop doing the wins and losses. It's not necessary. But with the RBI, I do think that you can look at that and say, all right, well, this is a person who, you know, managed to not get out of his comfort zone, not get out of his approach, and was able to deliver in a moment to bring in a run.
Yeah. And I think, as like a backward looking stat describing what happened, there's some value there. Now, if you're talking about, you know, free agent, and WAR has won, as it should. WAR is a way better stat, like, but it's so much better. So it's not even a discussion. I'm not comparing one to the other. But like, when you're looking ahead, what should Marcus Semien earn in free agency? Of course, you're looking at his WAR, his age, his projections. You're not looking at his RBI total. But for this year, as we're describing what has happened in 2021, I do think that there's some descriptive value in knowing that this team has six players who have driven in 80 plus runs. It just kind of, to me, speaks to the depth of this offense and how many runners are on base. And in a weird way, this flawed stat kind of encapsulates that.
See, I think what's interesting is that when you describe it as a flawed stat, what I would say that all numbers have a use. It's all about how you're weighing it and how you're, what's your application.
Yep.
Right. And I do think, like, you know, the way that you framed it there is like, it is a very descriptive stat. And I do think that there's something to it. Like, if you look at a guy over his career who consistently delivers in RBI situations, I mean, that's telling about a player. It's not necessarily predictive, but it's telling about how a player handles those moments, those types of at-bats. Is he the one who's going to buckle to the pitcher, or will he make the pitcher buckle? So I do think that there is some value in it, but it's all a question of how do you weigh it? How are you applying it? And how are you, you know, situating it within all the other measures that you're using with a player? And, you know, I think this is a regardless of how you frame it, you know, it's an incredible achievement for the Blue Jays. It's going to be certainly a sign of just how dominant, certainly a opening five they had, but just also the depth of the wider line of the lineup beyond them.
Yeah. And it's a huge reason that they're such a scary team, you know, to face as they move ahead and try to A, clinch a playoff spot, B, do some damage in the postseason. So before we wrap up here, I do want to touch on third base. And, you know, it's funny talking to Josh Donaldson, of course, at third baseman. He's having a pretty good year, better certainly than what the Blue Jays are getting. And I'm not saying they should have re-signed him, because I think it was probably time for both sides involved to kind of move ahead in different directions there. But, you know, you look at this Blue Jays third base mix, and I don't know what to make of it, Shy. I mean, you got Jake Lamb, you've got Breivik Valera, Espinal, Biggio, they're working their way back. What do you make of this mix right now?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Josh Donaldson in this lineup right now? Like, if you had Josh Donaldson batting sixth, you know, and that would be like a justified six, you know, for
seven, maybe eight.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just how nuts this lineup could potentially be. Okay, so let's look at the Blue Jays third base situation like this. So Jake Lamb is currently on the roster because he joined the club after August 31st. He will not be eligible for the postseason, right? So they've got the least invested in him right now. He's essentially on the outside looking in. Espinal and Biggio are on rehab. Espinal is closer. The sense that I got, I don't know, initially my impression was it was just going to be a game or two for him before he comes back. Talking to some people last night, it seems that it could be a little bit longer and that he may just get more rehab time in Buffalo this week. And then maybe he comes up potentially in Minnesota or potentially against the Yankees next week. I think part of what the Blue Jays are looking at there is, you know, is he going to be sharp? And, can you jump in and produce against Gerrit Cole right away? Yeah, I think that's the reality of the situation. That's what the Blue Jays need right now. And then with Kevin Biggio, it's a question mark. Like, what can he give you with that elbow injury? What can he realistically give you at the plate? And what can he give you in light of the challenges that he's faced throughout this season and the inability to provide any consistent production? So, I think the likeliest case for the Blue Jays right now is that they go into the postseason with some combination of Espinal and Valera at third base, should they make the postseason. And then, if Biggio can force the issue, then I think they'd be doing some backflips. But it's going to be tough for Biggio to force the issue. At least that's sort of the way that I see it right now. And then, is Kevin Smith something? Maybe. But, at this point, I don't know that's in play yet.
Yeah, it's kind of the only hole, when you look at the position player core for this team. And of course, as we zoom out, every single team in baseball would love to have the Blue Jays lineup and the Blue Jays group of position players, not only for this year, by the way, but also moving forward. It's pretty much the best group of position players in baseball. So that's, the context for viewing this third base mix right now. But within that, it's not good. Like if Espinal and Valera, that's your best case scenario, that's not good. So, we'll see where it goes. I tend to agree with you. I don't think that there's some sort of surprise emergence that we're necessarily going to see here. So, maybe you just settle for the occasional walk from Valera and the occasional defensive gem from Espinal. And that's kind of the way things unfold at that one position.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. I've been kicking this around. Like, does it make more sense for this team to just punt offense there? And not that you're totally punting on offense, but and not that Valera is giving you that much more, but to just say, whatever Espinal gives us at the plate is fine. Let's just get the defense there. Let's tighten that up and take care of our pitchers, as opposed to trying to squeeze out, the occasional. And Valera's done this on a handful of occasions this year where he's come up with a hit that's been game changing or a bit of a catalyst and been really important in a victory. Do you just say, Valera, we can't trust Valera's defense on a consistent basis at third. Let's just tighten that up. Espinal is going to give us plus defense. Let's do that. Take care of our pitchers. And if he contributes offensively, great. Or do you try to continue mixing and matching? I flip-flop on that one.
Yeah, to me, you almost do it by matchups. If you've got a ground ball pitcher, then you probably want Espinal. If Ryu's on the mound, for instance, if it's more of a fly ball pitcher, then maybe you go with Valera. And you can always do those switches, mid-game, as we're kind of seeing them do in center field with Dickerson and with Grichuk. They clearly like to get Lourdes Gurriel Jr. out of the game if they don't need runs. They obviously want his bat in the game when they do need runs. So, I think we're seeing a little bit of a shift toward that Rays Dodgers model where you're kind of adjusting on the fly every single game.
Yeah, and that's certainly, the Blue Jays have more toys on the bench now that allows them to play that game. And, that's why Jerrod Dyson's on this roster, so that he can get those moves. And we've seen him been brought in for both defensive and base running. You've seen the Blue Jays using the three catchers a bit more aggressively in the past couple of weeks as well. So, that's certainly the way that it wants to go. But, occasionally I just have these thoughts and just think, all right, whatever you're going to get on offense, it's not going to outweigh the defense. Even if you have a fly ball pitcher, it's just having that plus defender there who can steal a hit, on that one ball that just happens to be down the line. It's a play that Espinal makes and no one else on this roster does. And so, you know, do you just take that and give your pitchers all that you can, even if there's the matchup that day and Valera may make a bit more sense offensively?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. All right, Shai, you got a game to cover. I don't want to hold you up any longer. Thanks for making the time and co-hosting At the Letters with me this week.
Pleasure as always, Ben.
Awesome. Well, Arden Zwelling will be back next week as per usual. In the meantime, thanks to producers Christian Ryan and Nicholas Andrade, and of course to Miller Lite, which presents At the Letters every week. So thanks to Miller Lite, the original light beer. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good one.